Hello, I'm Angela Walsh, and welcome to the Downhill Slide. So, I've had a lot of changes in my life in the last few weeks. More changes. My life is nothing but change, it seems. I have had to reinvent myself so many times. I feel like Madonna, but without the money or the big expensive butt. Mind you, my butt is growing, but I paid for it in cake. Anyway, here I am starting a new career at the age of almost 54, and it feels really weird. With Anzac Day here again, it made me think about when conscription came in and the impact that must have had on young Australian men. I'm sitting here stressing over dealing with new software and company protocols. Those guys had to learn to kill, and they were shipped off to goodness knows where to do so. It must have been horrendous, and they didn't have a choice. I mean, basically, that's what conscription is. It gives the government the right to send you to fight. According to the Australian War Memorial website, the Defence Act 1903 was one of the first pieces of legislation passed by the new Commonwealth government for the purpose of home defence. In 1909, legislation for compulsory military training was introduced and passed in 1911, but was abolished by the Labor government after its election in October 1929. Shortly after the outbreak of the Second World War, it was revived and brought back again in 1951 and again in 1964. After 200 Australian service personnel were killed and 1,279 wounded in the Vietnam War, the National Service Scheme was abolished in 1972. The current Minister of Defence, Peter Dutton, said recently the only way to preserve peace is to prepare for war, and that's what they were doing in the past. I spoke with Laurie Kent. He was a NASHO, a national serviceman, one of those who was conscripted. He continues to do a lot of work for the organisation. He was a member of the early form of the Australian Army Reserve.
Well, in the National Service Association, I'm actually the oldest member. So it's quite unique. I feel as though you're the oldest bloke in the National Service. When I turned 16 in 1948, I joined the North Shore Regiment, the 1718 Battalion, as a regimental cadet. And this was the CMF, the Citizen Military Forces, before National Service started. And I did 2 years as a cadet. When I turned 18, I went into the proper regiment then as a private soldier and served 2 years there before I went into National Service in 1953, actually. I had it deferred because I was doing a TAFE course. So 1953, I went into Ingleburn Camp for 3 months. And before that, I'd been promoted to a sergeant in the CMF. So the first day in National, I had to take my stripes off and revert back to a private soldier again.
So is the CMF like the Army Reserves now?
Yes, that's right. The CMF was a pre-runner of the Army Reserve, yes. And we were prepared. We were training to go to war, but it didn't eventuate in that case. But we were quite ready to serve overseas, and we were training for war. Yes, so... after the 3 months, I reverted back to my old regiment, and the first night of the parade, the CO put my sergeant stripes back on again. But I still had to complete my 2 years part-time service as part of the National Service. But I stayed on until 1960 and was gradually promoted to lieutenant, first of all, and then finally to a captain. Before I retired, the CMF folded up in 1960, and later on they formed the Army Reserve.
Some wanted to join up, but were rejected, and that was the case for my dad, Johnny, and a few of his mates from Western Queensland. This would have been in the early 60s. He couldn't remember the exact year, but he could remember that he wasn't old enough to drink, so that means he wasn't 21.
See, the car was in my mother's name. Because those days you didn't have a license until you were 21.
So you mean you didn't actually have a driving license, or you mean you couldn't register a car?
No, none of us did. Yeah.
So you were allowed to drive on your mother's license?
Well, we did. Anyway, all of us did. We all had cars and that. But we weren't allowed in the pubs here because you had to be 21 to go in the pub. It was 18 down south.
So you're talking about Queensland. The age limit was 21.
That's correct.
So there were five of you headed off to Townsville.
Yeah. There was no bridges and that. They only had logs on the top of the sands and the bed of the river and all that sort of thing. And you had to plough the car through the sand or bounce over the logs and rocks. It took you from 4 o'clock in the morning till about 10 o'clock at night to get to Townsville. And there was a lot of driving, I can tell you. Anyway, so we get to Townsville. What was it? The old CWA, I think it was, in the next street. There was free accommodation. We stayed there the next day or whatever it was. We went down Sturt Street and we had a couple of few beers each and that at the Gannon's Hotel.
Wait a minute, how'd you get in there? You weren't 21.
They opened up any time you go through the back. Oh, yeah, you could go in any pub those days. Otherwise, they go broke. The police, they never worried you. Long as you didn't run amok or anything like that. Because if you start to play up in the pub, don't worry. The publican or he had someone there, you'd soon get out. Yeah, no worries. Everything was under control those days. and plus, all us young fellas, we looked after the pubs we drank at. If we were going to fight or anything, we used to go out in the street or the footpath. We never caused any strife in the pub. But anyway, so when we got to this little ex-Chinese shop, it was in Sturt Street, they had an office in there for all of us to, or anyone to sign up. They had forms there. You had an interview. And one at a time. And so, anyway, we all got rejected because our birthdays or something, they said. We weren't the right age in that certain time. But Robbie Smith, they took him because his parents had a bit of money and he was well educated because he was sent to Charter Stowers Boys School. And all us, we weren't educated, see. We were flat out riding and all that. So anyway, that was their excuse and that. But we tried, we got upset too, and we tried to explain to them. We could shoot, we could ride horses, we used to run down pigs and pull the oldies and that, and, you know, and that. So we just walked down to back down to Gannon's, and they couldn't believe it. And I still can't understand it to this day.
Some friends of mine were around a few years later than that. The Vietnam War went until 1975. Garrett spoke about what it was like to wait to see if your number was called up. It was kind of like a lottery, but not in a good way.
1968 was my year. That was the year when I turned 20. And I don't remember a great deal about the detail of it, but the general thing that was going on was in the year that you turned 20, your name went into a ballot, this ballot that was the draw, and it was televised just like, and I do remember this, it was just like the lotto draws that are done on TV these days, probably in a similar time slot. It certainly was early evening, probably around news time. I'm not sure how often, probably only once for the year, because what they did was drew out a series of numbers, which was dates. So it would be, I guess it worked like this. They draw out a number, which 1 to 12, which gives a month, and then they drew out a set of numbers, which would be a date or dates. And if your birthday was on one of those dates that came up, you were in. You were in the army for the next 2 years. That's how it worked. And when I say I don't remember the detail, my name didn't come up. That's a lottery where I didn't come up as a winner or loser, depending on which way you look at it. But I know other guys my age who remember with great vividness where they were watching TV because they were sweating on whether their number would come up or not. I was not sweating because I was actually one of, and it could have been a fairly large group, maybe larger than the than people who were aware of what was going on, who were against the conscription. For me, if my number had come up, I would have been quite happy about it. I would have been quite happy to go and serve my country. Now, the background of that is that I didn't come from a military family, far from it, but both my father and grandfather were in the Army, the Australian Army, AIF. My grandfather was, and there was conscription back in the, no, there wasn't. Back in the First World War, they were all volunteers. My grandfather was a volunteer. Now, and this is an interesting little bit of history that just popped into my mind. I think it was in 1917, there was a referendum on introducing conscription to send young Australian men overseas because they were running out of troops for the trenches for the First World War. And, of course, among the people who had a vote in that referendum were the troops who were already in the trenches themselves. And they voted overwhelmingly against that referendum. Nonetheless, I had a grandfather who came back from that First World War badly damaged. He was quite severely wounded to the extent that he was classified as totally and permanently incapacitated, but he did lead quite a full life beyond that and had a life as a sportsman and a businessman through the Depression years and so on. And my father, who was born just after the First World War, he was of the generation, again, he volunteered along with his cousins for the AIF in the Second World War. I think he was in about 1940. He was in the Middle East, certainly. He may have been of a sub-generation that were known as the deep thinkers, because there was a group of guys who just volunteered in 1939 to go off for what they saw as a great adventure. My father was a year or two after that, but I do know for him and his cousins, who all went out to war together, they volunteered because in their eyes they were going on a grand adventure that was going to get them out from under the deprivations that they'd suffered as teenagers in the Depression. And again, they came back from the war. I would definitely say my father came back from from the Second World War damaged. Not damaged physically, but damaged mentally. He, in turn, brought me up in an environment where my brother and I grew up in an environment where we kind of expected that that's what happens. That's what happens with us, this family. When you're about 20, the country puts out a call and you respond. And off you go in uniform and go off and fight a war, because that's what happened in his generation and that's what happened in my grandfather's generation. So when that came around, the whole Vietnam thing, to me it was kind of pretty much expected. Yeah, that's what we do. So if the call came, I would not have objected at all. I would have been off there. And I do know absolutely, even though I didn't get anywhere near going there, if I had gone, I would have come back damaged by the experiences, assuming that I went into combat. Because I don't know many, but there were young guys of my age who I do know, did know, some before and after, others really I only knew them after. And in that group, there are suicides, there are people who are still suffering from PTSD 50 or more years later, and they're really paying the price for going away and answering the call of the government of the day.
Barb spoke of somebody she knew who actually broke his arm in order not to serve, and others, people that she worked with, who were really proud to be called up and to go and fight for their country. So where were you working?
Well, I started work at ATVO, as it was these days, Channel O, which subsequently became Channel 10, in February 1970.
We're talking about Vietnam War?
Yes, right in the thick of it. It was all around us. It was on the news every night. There were protests and demonstrations and... In my little area, I was in a glass cage with an audio operator putting the TV station to air, and through the glass on the right, there was another glass cage, and that was the technical people, master control, and also a section along one side of that called CCU, which is the camera control unit. So all the techies were to the right of me, and they were pretty much all men. In fact, I don't remember one master control female or one CCU operator female. So over the couple of years subsequent to 1970, I watched a number of these young fellows leave, and having been conscripted, and they were always looking forward to it, go and serve their country. They were quite happy to get in there, get in the action, and they come back very much subdued, and it was very difficult to get them to talk about anything associated with it. They knew it was unpopular and they just didn't want to talk about it.
Well, there were demonstrations, weren't there, back then?
Oh, absolutely. You know, every night in the news there was a demonstration somewhere or other campaigning against, first of all, conscription. 19-year-old young men who couldn't vote yet were being called upon to go and get shot at in a foreign country that we didn't really have anything to do with. We were there to support our big brother America, who was completely involved. They were fighting against the communists. And so there was a lot of activity protesting against that. There was a number of conscientious objectors. People such as Simon Townsend, if you remember him, he ended up in jail quite a bit. And when Whitlam was elected, suddenly all the conscientious objectors could be freed. That was a monumental day, I remember. What was that song? There were no D-Day marches in 1973. It was so unpopular, and they didn't feel like they could be proud. They could be proud amongst their own fellow conscriptees or fellow nashos, they called them, but they didn't feel as if they could be proud in the general populace, because there was so many people against it. And they came back so different, grown up men. You could see something in them. Now that we know some of the things that went on in those times, it's quite amazing. And you can understand, amazing in a bad way, but you can understand how they reacted when they came back, you know. I heard people avoided conscription just down here in the surfing area along the coast. Many surfers developed a kind of a sort of kneeling on their board. They develop a lump on their foot, which, you know, about the size of a quail's egg or something, which all surfers get when they surface, when they do a lot of surfing. And that precluded them from going into the being conscripted as well, because they couldn't do their boots up. So that was another one. So they could surf real hard for a few years, develop the lump, and they could be almost guaranteed of not joining up. And a number of people took off into the tropics and disappeared in the jungle somewhere. There are a few people hiding out, wouldn't be called up.
Would you believe it, but I heard a young woman talking about the possibility of Australia going to war soon and whether her brothers would sign up or be conscripted. I was astounded, really, that such a conversation was being held around the family dining table in 2022. But with what's happening with Russia invading Ukraine, as well as our own tense relationship with China, I suppose it is good that their family is having such an open discussion, because who would have thought we would have wars continuing to rage in 2022? I thought we were more enlightened by now. Anyway, let's hope conscription does not return. I think joining the armed forces willingly results in a better defender, but there is merit to military training. I was in the Navy a long time ago, and there were a couple of reasons I left. However, I learned a lot that was of value, and I have no regrets. I have a great deal of respect for those who serve and have served. It's not an easy thing to do, and as we have seen with the war in Ukraine, sometimes there is nothing left to do but fight for your country, for your way of life. But what's left afterwards is never what it was. In the words of Norman Whitefield and Barrett Strong, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Stay safe. Thanks for listening.